Welcome to Multifamily Real Estate Investing, presented by Mara Poling. My name is Pat Poling. I'm the founder and CEO of Mara Poling, and I'm excited to be with you this week to continue our series on the Mara Poling investment thesis. This week, we'll be talking about why performing assets. Performing assets is one of the criteria we think makes a great deal of sense when building a multifamily portfolio for yourself and when investing with a sponsor in a passive investment. Investing in assets that are performing lowers risk, has increased opportunities for better debt, lots and lots of benefits, and we're going to talk about all that this week. As always, if you have any questions, shoot me an email, pat@marapoling.com. I want to invite you in particular this week to swing by marapoling.com and check out the new offerings page. We are very excited to have just come to market with several new offerings. A follow-on to our very successful Total Return Fund One called, unsurprisingly, Total Return Fund 2, a new offering that we're very excited about, Growth Fund 1, which we've mentioned previously, essentially the double-double in practical sense, and some new opportunities that will be coming. There'll be a Growth Fund 2 that'll be launching a little bit, maybe in the next 30 days or so, and some individual asset syndications, as well as some information about our private investment service. So if you have any interest at all in learning more about how you might work with us, and I'd also encourage you, if you're simply trying to learn more about how to invest in multifamily real estate, check out our funds. I'm not doing that to entice you to become an investor. It really is a great way to learn. Anytime I would suggest that you can look at the document set for any investment, I'd encourage you to do so. It's a great way to learn more about how all the different kinds of investments in multifamily are structured. So that's at marapoling.com, marapoling.com. You can go to the offerings page. I'd also encourage you swing by the webinars page. We have several webinars scheduled about the new offerings. Again, wonderful educational opportunities. And if you are in fact interested in becoming a multifamily real estate investor, then you absolutely want to participate in those sessions. Okay, enough of that. Let's get to performing assets. So what do we mean by a performing asset? It's the fifth step in our investment thesis. We've previously talked about a number of items. Just recently, we took a look at growth markets and why growth markets were important. Prior to that, we focused on Class B multifamily. Why is that the Goldilocks class? Before that, we looked at just why multifamily in general. What is it about multifamily that we really like? And we started off by taking a look at commercial real estate, the benefits that we get by investing in real estate relative to other kinds of investments that are out there. And we still have more to come. In the following weeks, we'll take a look at value add and working the full cycle and 1031 chains. Lots of great opportunities to continue to understand how multifamily operates. But this week, we're talking about performing assets. So what do we mean by a performing asset? Well, we've got a handout. Now, it's not essential for those of you that aren't registered or subscribed to Multifamily Real Estate Investing presented by Mara Poling. If you would like a copy of this handout, just shoot me an email, pat@marapoling.com. And if you would like to get subscribed, which includes early access to a brief snippet of the following week's session, as well as a copy of any handouts that are involved in that session, again, shoot me an email, or you can go to marapoling.com and check out the podcast page, and you can register there as well. So performing assets. A performing asset, by our definition, is an asset that is greater than 90% occupied. Okay, what do we mean by 90% occupied? That seems pretty straightforward. If I've got 100 units, 90 of the units are occupied. Well, sort of. Occupancy is one of the ways you can measure occupancy is by physical occupancy. Another is to say occupancy is equal to 100% minus economic vacancy. And economic vacancy includes three different factors. One of those is physical vacancy. How many units are actually empty, meaning there's no lease there. Another component, though, is bad debt, which essentially is how many units are physically occupied. So there's a lease in place, but that tenant isn't paying their rent for whatever reason. Life happens to people. We understand that. In any given property at any given point in time, there will be tenants that will either be behind or in some instances simply not able to pay their rent. We build that into our forecasts. That is not a surprise. That is not an unfavorable variance. Now, if it was 20% of the property, yes, that would be an unfavorable variance. But we expect out of 100 units that one or two tenants are probably not going to pay their rent. That's simply built into the model. So we want to take 100%. We want to subtract the physical vacancy, and we want to subtract the bad debt. The other component of economic vacancy, which is concessions, we actually aren't going to do anything with. And here's the reason why. It's included in economic vacancy or total vacancy or effective vacancy in large part because lenders look at it that way. And we like how lenders look at things. So we want to look at things the way lenders do. We don't include it here because if you think about a concession is really a conversation around the rental rate, not necessarily about the actual occupancy of the property. If you give someone a concession, well, that's an occupied unit and they're paying their rent. That's really satisfactory in terms of being occupied. The fact that they maybe are paying a little less every month, or they got a deal on their first month or their fifth month or their last month or however the concession was structured, that's really more an issue of what the average overall rent is the property experiences. So when we define performing assets, we're looking at assets that are 90% occupied or better as defined by 100% minus the physical vacancy minus bad debt. So to be at 90%, a property might be 9% physically vacant. So out of 100 units, 9 are empty. And you've got, in the aggregate, one tenant's worth of non-rent payment. If we're less than that, let's talk about what it looks like if we're less than that. So a non-performing asset. So we've got an asset that's 12% physically vacant. So 100 units, 12 of the units are empty. And they could be empty for lots of reasons. They could be empty because they're ready to lease and they're on the market and they're simply not leasing. They could be partially ready to lease. Of the 12, maybe 6 are ready to lease, but maybe 6 are still in the process of being turned or having some improvements done to them. That makes them no less vacant. It does give you a different understanding, though, about the performance level of the asset. So if I were looking at purchasing an asset that had a higher than 10% physical vacancy, for example, I'd want to understand why. For example, we've purchased properties that have had insurance issues. There's been some damage from a storm or possibly a fire. And so there's 4 units that are down units. Well, they're down units. They're vacant. And they're vacant for a reason. They're not vacant because the market has said we don't value living there as much as we might somewhere else. They're vacant because they're really not part of the inventory. And so that's something we need to take into account. We also want to look at the property that is maybe 92% physically occupied. So 100 units and only 8 are vacant. but 10 of the tenants aren't paying rent. So in both of those instances, if you think about it, if we were to purchase those properties, we would have some significant work to do in improving the performance of that asset. Now, how do you do that? Well, in one instance, the physical vacant issue, we've got to get those units on the market, and we've got to get them on the market in a competitive manner so that we can get into the 90s and ideally into the mid 90s. If I'm purchasing an asset and that's what it looks like, there's going to be a number of factors I'm going to look at to determine whether or not I want to purchase that asset. Generally speaking, I don't want to do that. And there may be some economic reasons that keep me from doing that. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But ideally, I'm purchasing an asset that is 90% or better in terms of physical occupancy, inclusive of the calculation of bad debt. What if bad debt's the issue? What if we're 94% physically occupied, but we've got 10% of the tenants not paying rent? Okay, then in our due diligence, we want to understand more about the tenant base. How were they qualified? What were the standards relative to income that were used? How long tenured are the tenants? If this is a property that has tenants that have been there not a year or 2 years or 3 years on average, but that have been there 5 years or 8 years or 10 years, and it's been that long since they went through a qualification process, there could be issues that have occurred. And we want to understand how we can take care of that. If we're purchasing an asset, that's part of the conversation we may have with the seller of, for us to close on this property and successfully secure the debt that we're looking for, these kinds of improvements in performance need to happen and be sustained. And we've done that in some instances. We've also had properties, and this is sort of the exception that proves the rule, where we have purchased them when they've been less than 90%. There are consequences associated with that and opportunities. And that's what we're going to talk about now, is what happens if it's less than 90? What about that initial batch in 90 where it's 90 to 93? What about the high end where it's 97 plus? And then what about that sweet spot that we want to be in? So let's take a look at those four categories. Less than 90%. We would generally describe that as being a heavy lift. What we mean by that is it's going to take a lot more work to get that property where we want it to be than a property that's at 90 or better. That doesn't necessarily mean we have to put more capital into it. That could be part of it. It isn't necessarily that, though. We're going to be delayed in our ability to move rents. Rent movement is a function of supply and demand for our specific inventory. And if we're less than 90%, then we are not in a position to compete yet for higher rents. The improvements might be substandard. So we might be purchasing 1980s classic units. And by that, I mean units where the market today doesn't simply look at them and say, well, that's acceptable, but at a lower rent. We're getting to a point in the market cycle where tenants in Class B are simply drawing a line and saying, that is not acceptable. I won't consider renting that regardless of how much you might discount the unit. And that could be one of the issues here. It's challenging to do value add work when you're having to do all of that. And this is probably the biggest issue. In general, it is difficult to get agency debt for a property that is occupied in the 80s. And if I can't get agency debt, that means I'm getting more expensive bridge debt and I'm on the clock, meaning that debt expires at a relatively short point in time. And that's more challenging for us. Can we buy properties below 90? And have we? Yes, we can. And yes, we have. In most instances, we've been successful and we've had delayed rent movement. We had to spend money getting the interiors up to spec. who either had to delay or were challenged in terms of doing much value add, and we had to do it without agency debt. So it really proves the model that while you can dip below 90, we really don't want to do it. So we want to be at 90 or better. And what's magic about 90? So let's talk about that low end, 90 to maybe 93. Well, as I said, we can get agency debt. Agency debt's really valuable. Agency debt is, we believe, the highest quality debt that we can place on a property. It's a good place to start. If I'm in the 90 to 93 range, I've got some upside to be made simply by improving occupancy. And as I improve occupancy, I can move rent. I've got to be careful about rent movement in the very beginning. I'm probably more focused on renewals of tenants that are significantly below the average of the property. Here's an example. We're averaging $900. The market is at $1,050. Boy, we want to add that $150, but we can't yet because we're not in that sweet spot, 93 to 97. But what we can do is look at the tenants that are paying maybe $600 a month and work on getting them to $900, because we've got evidence in our rent roll that we've been able to rent the property at $900. And so we can have some degree of assertiveness relative to renewals, although our real focus is getting occupancy into that sweet spot of the mid-90s. What about a property that's amazingly occupied, 97, 98, 99%, or as they will sometimes claim, 100%, which mathematically you can't do 100%. For those of you that are newer to the podcast and maybe haven't heard us talk about this before, 100% would mean that every tenant renews every year, nobody ever moves out, and if that's what's happening, not only are you not managing the renewal opportunity well, but you've also got a very odd tenant base. They're not getting married and buying a house. They're not moving because they've got a new job. They're not having life events that cause them to relocate. That's just odd. So you're never really going to be at 100%. And if you are essentially full, well, when a tenant doesn't renew, and you don't want every tenant to renew, you need some inventory. When a tenant doesn't renew, they don't move out on the third and the new tenant move in on the fourth. If they move out on the third, at a minimum, it takes some number of days to get the unit ready for the new tenant to move in. If there's an improvement effort underway, it might take a few weeks to have it ready. And even if a tenant says, great, I'm going to rent that unit, and they do it before the individual moves out, they're likely not asking to move in on the fourth. They're going to say, oh, I'd like to move in on the first because my lease expires at the end of the month and I'd like to do that. Or I'd like to move in on the 28th and have a little bit of overlap. You add all those little pieces up and you get to 97 or 98%. That's fully occupied. Another way to say it is you're overoccupied. There is an immediate and significant rent movement opportunity. And the reason for that is you can't see what the real market is for your property because you're selling out of inventory. It's George and the taco truck. If you haven't heard that episode, search for it in your podcast. It's a fun little series that we talked about. So there's an opportunity to move rents in a meaningful way, both on renewals and on new inventory, which you will get as you begin to be more aggressive on renewals. Value add is a bit of a challenge because you need inventory to do it. So if I've got 100 units, I have about 8 units on average that expire every month. I would like 4 of those to say, great, we'd love to stay. I'd love all 8 to want to stay, but I'd want 4 of them to actually stay. And I'd want 4, maybe some of them are moving or buying a home, but I also want some of them to leave because, gee, you're asking more for this unit than I'm willing to pay. And I'm confident I am confident, based on our occupancy, that we can get that higher rent in the open market. So we get some inventory. We also need inventory to do improvements. If we had half of the units vacant each month, each of the expiring units vacant, then it would take us 2 years to get through a large number of the units. Now, every tenant isn't gonna, you're not gonna have every unit move out over the course of 2 years, meaning half move out this year because they don't renew, and next year it's the other half. There will always be some tenants that renew and renew and renew. And if we're getting nice increases, that's okay. We're comfortable doing that. But your value add timing can be delayed when you're over occupied. So below 90, some real challenges in terms of putting ourselves in a position where we can be successful. It's doable. There's more work to be done. In that low 90s, we're getting into a good position. We've got some upside, but we're going to have, again, a few challenges in terms of how quickly we can move rents and how fast we can get to our value add projects. If we're over occupied, it's great news in terms of being able to move rents, and it's still going to delay us in terms of our value add work, which leads us to the sweet spot. 93 to 97. So if we're looking to purchase an asset and it's over 90 and it's actually in the mid 90s, we like that. That's the sweet spot. That means there's opportunities to move rents because we're being told by the marketplace that the current rents are a good value. And we're able to step right into the value add program because we've got a reasonable amount of units available to us on a regular basis. Let's say we're at 94%. That means we have six vacant units. We could have two or three or even four of those somewhere in the value add process. And we can lease a unit within when it's in value add. A tenant moves out, as I said, maybe they move out in the third. It goes into the value add process and it's going to be available for someone to move in by the first. We can lease that unit. It can be in our inventory and with an availability date of the first of the month and leased as a value add unit. So why do we like performing assets? Well, if the assets are performing, there's less work for us to do. And that doesn't mean that we're lazy. It simply means that our energies can be focused on the items that are really going to move the needle, as opposed to on those more riskier items where we really got to just get the property in shape. We can get what we believe to be higher quality debt. We can get right to the issue of being able to move rents, and we can start our value add investing right away. Well, there's a lot of properties out there that aren't performing. What happens with those? There are investment groups, and you may have some assets like this in your portfolio if you've built your own. There are investment groups that focus on non-performing assets. That's part of their investment thesis. Why? There's more upside. You can pay less for a dollar of NOI on a non-performing unit than you would on a performing unit. That gives you the opportunity to get it to a place where it's performing and then sell it. And who do they sell it to? They sell it to me because I want to buy performing assets. So in our ecosystem, there are firms that have evolved to fit each of the niches to make sure that someone is there to support all of the types of properties that are out there. We focus on performing assets, and there are others that focus on transforming non-performers into performers so that they can go to someone like us. So that's the next step in our process. I mentioned a moment ago some of the items that are coming up. So let me briefly touch on those. We're going to get into value add in 2 weeks. Value add is just the funnest part of this entire process. All of these steps are important. Value add's really fun because it is the closest thing we've got to a secret sauce, and there's no secret about it. But we're going to talk about value add, how that works, some of the really solid value add performers and how value add evolves over time because the market is not stagnant. Following that, we're going to talk about working the cycle, the full cycle. And I'm not talking about the real estate cycle. I'm talking about the life cycle of an individual asset. So that'll be a really valuable one to look at. We're going to finish up with 1031 chains. We think there's a lot of value to be had by utilizing the unique tax advantages that we are afforded by being investors in real estate. And in doing so, we can improve our returns, our cash returns, and our equity growth over time in some really significant ways, and yet do so in which we don't violate the other tenants that are contained in our investment thesis. We don't take on more risk. We will, when we're all done with this, talk about ways that you can then employ these eight elements of our investment thesis, how you can do that through passive investments, how you can do that through obviously passive investments working with us, and also how you can do that if you're building your own personal portfolio. So I hope you found this week's session valuable. Please remember to swing by marapoling.com. Check out those webinars that are coming up. Check out the offerings page. If you have any questions about any of that, don't hesitate to shoot me an email, pat@marapoling.com. And I look forward to you joining us next week for another episode of Multifamily Real Estate Investing presented by Mara Poling.